Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, an about face on climate change. From day one, President Biden has made addressing global warming a priority of his administration. He created a climate czar, re-entered the Paris Agreement, and last week he signed executive actions that would limit drilling on federal lands and promote the development of electric cars. But it's not just the government that seems to have broken with the climate denialism of the Trump years. General Motors jolted the auto industry Thursday when it announced it will stop manufacturing gas-powered cars by 2035. Coral Davenport covers energy, environmental policy, and climate change for the New York Times. She joined me Tuesday morning to talk about just how much of a difference these actions could make in the fight against our warming planet. Let's start with last week's announcement by General Motors about their new goals on zero emission vehicles. Tell me how surprising that was.
Well, in some sense, it was really a total U-turn for GM. The CEO of General Motors, Mary Barra, went in and met with former President Donald Trump in the first weeks of his administration. So in the early weeks of 2017, she went in, met with him and said, look, there's these, you know, tough Obama era fuel standards. They're forcing us to make electric vehicles. We're not ready to do it. It's too hard on the industry. You've got to roll these back. And I mean, that was music, honestly, to former President Trump's ears. That ended up being the rollback of those fuel economy standards for vehicles ended up being really the centerpiece of his deregulatory agenda. He did it. It was completed last year. It was one of the last really big regulatory rollbacks. And in so doing, it basically stripped away the single largest policy that the federal government had in place to combat climate change. Vehicle tailpipes are the number one contributor to climate warming pollution in the U.S. Those fuel economy standards, those tough fuel economy standards, which would have required automakers to meet a standard of about 54 miles per gallon by 2025, essentially requiring them to invest and sell aggressively in electric vehicles, all gone. General Motors was pretty much with the White House the whole way. One of the things that the Trump administration did, in addition to rolling back those standards, the state of California has its own very tight state level standards for vehicles. And so the Trump administration also legally revoked the state's authority to have its own standards. And GM signed on with the Trump administration in that lawsuit. And so it was really, you know, it makes sense that major U.S. companies would want to align themselves with the policymaker in chief in the White House. But, you know, I have to tell you, Diane, when I talked to people in the industry and who follow the industry, who watched how just 2 weeks after the election, Mary Barra, the CEO of GM, pulled GM from that lawsuit. And then last week came out with this announcement that basically was sort of saying, and now we're 100% on board with the Biden administration. I mean, that is, and for the company to act alone, the other major automakers were furious that GM was sort of had pushed for one thing during the Trump administration, been side by side, like hand in hand with Donald Trump, and then flipped around and done this. So just watching this giant auto company literally just do a U-turn, according to who's in the White House, is very audacious. But at the same time, it's still a huge deal. They are the largest and most iconic auto company in the U.S., and they are very publicly making this huge commitment to basically end manufacturing combustion engines, fuel combustion engines. Now, they have not legally bound themselves to doing this. There's no legal requirement. There's no, if they don't do it, if they don't succeed, essentially what happens is, you know, in 15 years, if they haven't achieved this goal, they can say, well, we put out a press release 15 years ago, but things have changed. And Mary Barra, the CEO, is long gone. But it's still, it's a tremendous kind of public statement that GM is prepared to go in a very different way.
So the announcement came the day after Biden signed the executive order on climate change. And clearly that had to be in her thinking as to what's coming.
100%. 100%. And we should point out, President Biden has now signed sort of two tranches of executive orders on climate change. On day one, he signed executive orders that had to do with over 100 environmental protections, environmental regulations, many of which had been rolled back by President Trump, former President Trump. And one of those, one of the day one orders was, we need to immediately start the legal work of reinstating those tough fuel economy rules. They didn't put numbers on it, but it's very clear they want to, you know, either reinstate or strengthen something that looked like the Obama fuel economy rule. So that was day one. Then 1 week later, he signed sort of a second tranche of climate orders. But that was, you know, that was right there. And it was expected. I mean, President Biden, he campaigned on that. He campaigned on climate change. This was the biggest federal climate change regulation that had been in place. So it was understood that that was going to happen. But it was sort of amazing to see, just as soon as the ink was dried, the automakers, and you know, I don't know if you saw the news just this morning, Diane, the other major automakers, Fiat Chrysler, Toyota, just this morning, they put out an announcement as well saying, we're going to drop that California lawsuit too. You know, we're no longer going to back the Trump administration's legal effort to revoke what California is doing. So this is a big victory for the Biden administration. It is a very remarkable thing and very different from the Obama administration to have this whole industry come to the table and say, we're here, we're ready to work, let's do it, bring on the new regulations. That is remarkable. It's a sea change.
The other factor here, it seems to me, is Tesla. Tesla has been making so much money, apparently it's worth more than GM, Toyota, VW, and Ford put together.
They're paying close attention to that. Absolutely. And, you know, as soon as GM made that announcement about going all electric, its stock prices went up right away. And it's clear that you would not be a good CEO if you were not considering how these announcements would be affecting your stock prices and considering how much money your competitors are making on this technology. I have not interviewed Mary Barra personally about this, but I've talked to a lot of people in the industry and they said, yeah, ultimately, you know, what drives a company is, you know, what they're giving back to their shareholders more necessarily than the environment. But
this is a win for both. It could be. So in the past, these very same automakers have argued this is going to hurt the economy. We're going to lose jobs. So how true is that going to be?
Well, some of it is true. And here's why. One of the biggest differences between manufacturing sort of the standard combustion engine vehicle and electric vehicles is electric vehicles take a lot less labor. You need fewer people to assemble electric vehicles. And so the industry is not wrong. As they make that transition, the actual work of putting together the components of an electric vehicle will require fewer workers. And I do think that the Biden White House and the President Biden himself are very attuned to that. Very attuned. Those are labor jobs. Those are manufacturing jobs. Those are the kinds of workers and the kinds of voters that, you know, could go either way. You know, those are Trump voters who took a leap and voted for Biden, and he does not want to lose them. And so what the goal here is, the jobs that are not in the U.S. associated with electric vehicles are manufacturing the batteries. So most of those are manufactured abroad. So I think what we will see the administration try to do is put in place policies to bring the battery making plants to the U.S. And that, you know, you lose jobs in making the cars and then you can gain jobs in making the batteries. Right now, those jobs are not in the U.S. And so that is one of the big challenges. That's one of the big concerns of the auto companies. But it is one that the administration is highly tuned into. You know, and the question is, can you make that happen?
Exactly. But, you know, I remember when Zeke belts were the big issue. And all of the automobile industry was crying out and saying, you're going to cost us jobs. You're going to make cars more expensive. You're going to lose jobs. I mean, it's the same argument, and we've always managed to come out ahead.
And it's also true, Diane, that there are a lot of economic studies on the job impacts of environmental regulations. You know, and there's been enough big environmental regulations in the U.S. that there's a lot of material that you can analyze. And overall, and I talked to a lot of labor economists about this, they said historically, the job result of environmental regulations tends to be a net wash. You do lose jobs in the older industries, in polluting industries, you know, in the industries that you're kind of regulating out of business, and you create new jobs in the cleaner technology, in environmental mitigation. And over time, those numbers do historically even out. So, you know, I think it's right to say that environmental regulations both create and destroy jobs, and it works out. And so the hard part is, you know, can you make a match? Can you create the jobs in the same geographical regions where the jobs are lost? Or can the skills match up? You know, and again, over time, the numbers do work out. And again, so this is going to be the crux of it. But over time, you're also cleaning up the environment. And I should say a very important piece of economic data that we see now is that there's a lot of studies showing that climate change is hurting the economy.
Yes.
The increased impacts of climate change, stronger wildfires, more flooding, you know, damage to road and road closures. All of that takes a significant economic toll as well. You know, there's studies showing that unmitigated climate change could take 10% off the U.S. GDP by the end of this century if nothing happens. So that is a piece of the equation as well. You know, you go through some of this disruption, but what you're avoiding is a much bigger hit spread out over the whole economy.
Indeed. And you talk about moving the construction of batteries to this country. What kind of training is going to be offered or retraining for those who've been involved in making these combustible engine automobiles and now have to retrain to do something else? Is there retraining money involved?
Well, one of the things that President Biden did in his executive orders last Wednesday was to create a task force essentially devoted to studying this, sort of studying the job losses in fossil fuel and manufacturing communities. What will be the losses? What do you need to do? Do you need to retrain? How much money is it going to cost? And, you know, it's a task force. It's a task force to study. That's what the executive order did. You know, the government has had mixed success with taking this kind of thing on before. One example is when federal regulations, you know, worked to shut down smoking and raise taxes on tobacco and essentially end smoking. I mean, there were a lot of job losses in agricultural communities. And overall, it's clear that there's a societal and economic good associated with that. But you still have to figure out, you know, what do you do with entire communities of tobacco farmers that have lost their jobs? And so there's a mixed record of success in how well the government has and hasn't in the past identified, acknowledged that problem and tried to figure it out. And so I think they're looking, I think they're just starting this.
So the automobile industry is just one part of the Biden clean climate move. And one of those elements is about drilling on land that Trump made a big push to open federal lands to drilling. So what happens now in the Biden administration in that regard?
So what President Biden has done with these executive orders is they've put a temporary pause on new leases on public land, which is actually the minority of drilling. So if there's already drilling there, the drilling is still happening. You know, the way this works is the federal government sells leases to oil companies. The oil companies purchase the leases, pay royalties to the federal government, and choose to drill or not drill, Sometimes they just lock down the land. And so what they've done is they've put a temporary moratorium on selling new leases with the idea of, you know, this is sort of the first step is, again, kind of let's put a halt, let's study it, let's kind of figure this out. But it is widely seen as the first legal step towards ultimately probably putting a long-term or permanent moratorium on new drilling and fracking on public lands. And this adds up to putting maybe 10% of public lands off limits. Most of the drilling and fracking in the US is still being done on private lands. So it doesn't mean ending drilling and fracking, and it doesn't mean ending drilling and fracking on public lands, but it does mean, you know, I would anticipate that they would continue to follow through. It would mean ending new drilling and fracking on public lands. And that would be a very, very significant step, although I don't think it's fair to say that it would shut down the industry in any way.
Okay, now, how much of Trump's deregulation agenda has Biden been able to reverse? And how easy is it going to be for him to continue to reverse those deregulations that Trump put in place?
That's a really important question, Diane, because of course, all we've seen so far are executive orders.
Yeah.
And I want to be clear, while Biden has, you know, put a temporary moratorium on new leases on public lands, that's a little pause button on leases, and is moving forward with reinstating these standards for vehicle fuel pollution, federal regulations take 2 or 3 years to get done. That is just, there's a legal process. It takes a really long time. There's time limits, or rather there's certain time requirements. For example, if Biden wants to put in place these fuel economy standards to replace the Trump standards, the federal government will have to propose a new standard, hold that open for 60 to 90 days for public comments. They will probably get easily 1 million public comments. They will have to legally review all of those. They will have to put forth very detailed economic analyses, legal analyses.
It's not just a matter of overturning.
No. So there's a long process. Again, kind of sticking with the fuel pollution rules, my guess is that the fastest they get new rules in place is probably 2 years. If they got new rules in place at the beginning of 2023, that would be very, very fast. And it's important to remember that until those new rules are in place, the Trump rules remain the law of the land, the lax Trump regulations. And so in terms of rolling back many of these regulations, there's a pretty clear legal path. They know what to do. They know how to do it. They can use the regulatory process, but it takes a long time. And as you mentioned, Diane, the Trump administration rolled back over 100 environmental rules, regulations, policies. There's all of this. And at the same time, the Biden administration is going in with a much smaller staff at EPA. You know, they'll have to beef that up. They'll need to beef up the budget. You know, they have fewer people to do this job, and they do just have this really, really big job to do. So they can, but your listeners should understand that this is not something that happens overnight. I would expect, you know, for them to get the biggest rules all done easily takes the whole first term or one whole presidential term.
When we come back, the rest of my conversation with Coral Davenport.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily. Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with Coral Davenport. She covers energy and environmental policy for the New York Times. You know, it's interesting that Biden has put environmental justice at the center of his plan. He's directed agencies across the federal government to invest in low-income and minority communities that traditionally have felt the brunt of pollution. So how important is that to his whole plan?
It was so interesting to see Biden do this because no president has ever talked about, you know, I don't remember Obama ever really talking about the issue of environmental justice, which really is specifically, as you said, it is the concept which is borne out in the data that low income and minority communities tend to be disproportionately affected by pollution, whether by air pollution, whether by being near highways and industry and power plants, or by being located in areas that are more vulnerable to the impacts of climate change. And the idea is to say, we've got to pay special attention to these communities. We've got to give more money to help them. And I think that the biggest thing is just that the president has highlighted it, talked about it, gotten this idea, injected this idea into the mainstream. You know, I think this was not an idea that a lot of voters necessarily could easily grasp or were familiar with before. Now this is a top presidential agenda item. So, I mean, I think that's the first thing, just elevating it into kind of the mainstream policy discourse is new. And he's attaching some dollar figures. You know, he's got a proposal that 40% of spending associated with environmental mitigation will go to environmental justice communities. So that is something that we will start, would probably see reflected in the most powerful of government documents, the federal budget. So that's a big deal. And the fact that he's saying in other agencies, in housing and urban development, in agriculture, you know, you have to take this into consideration when making your budget, when making your policies, and that we would see that reflected in those agencies' budgets. That will have an impact, I think.
So you wrote that in some ways, what Biden has done so far on climate is actually the easy stuff. So what's next?
So, you know, part of it is, again, turning all these executive orders into actual regulation. The regulations also will have to be legally triple bulletproof because all of these are going to be legally challenged and they're going to go to the Supreme Court. And this is the most conservative Supreme Court that we've seen in a generation. And this Supreme Court has justices who have a record of being pretty clear about not supporting the government's legal authority to sort of put in place broad new regulations on industry. And in some cases, again, I'll go back to this fuel economy rule, which is so important because it's the biggest source of climate pollution. The statute, the Clean Air Act, is pretty clear about the federal government's authority to regulate tailpipe pollution. That's built in the law. And the expectation is if they do that rule pretty solidly and by the book, it'll probably go to the Supreme Court, but there's a strong chance that it would be upheld. Not all those other regulations will have such an easy ride. There's a regulation that the Obama administration did on the second largest source of greenhouse gas emissions in the U.S. That's coal-fired power plants. The Obama administration did this big regulation on power plants. It was called the Clean Power Plan. And the Supreme Court actually put a stay on it, which means Supreme Court Chief Justice Roberts said, essentially, don't implement this plan until all of the legal disputes have been resolved. And so it never was implemented. And that was also a clear sign by the Supreme Court at the time that they thought that plan was not legally very sound, that it really was a big question of whether or not that would stand up. And so if Biden tries to go back and re-implement that plan, the Supreme Court is even more conservative. And so there's a big question, I think, on whether and how the federal government can regulate coal-fired power plants and their contribution to climate change, about whether what would be the legal standing. It is considered that this Supreme Court, that would have a really tough case to make in front of this Supreme Court. And that might be very hard for them to do.
So what about the Paris Climate Accords? What happens now? How significant is it that we now have John Kerry at the helm overseeing climate change? And how forceful an argument can be made that those accords are important for the U.S. to be part of?
I think there's a tremendous argument to be made that the U.S., which is the world's largest economy and largest historic greenhouse gas polluter, if the U.S. is not part of the Paris Climate Accord, that takes a huge, you know, when President Trump withdrew the U.S. from the Paris Climate Accord, in which nearly every other country in the world is a legal party, that was a huge gut punch to kind of the global ability to deal with climate change. For the U.S. to reenter it is also a very big deal. And we immediately, you know, heard voices from around the world saying, we welcome the U.S. back. This is great. Appointing John Kerry as the U.S.'s international climate envoy was a huge move. All the climate diplomats and world leaders around the world know John Kerry because he was one of the lead brokers of the original Paris Climate Accord. He helped write it. He was in the room. He was at the heart of that deal. He has so much respect from the world leaders who care about climate change. They understand that he cares about this, that he knows it, that he brought all of the strength and clout that he had as Secretary of State to try to get that deal done. All of that said, none of it matters if the U.S. doesn't actually take any action, domestic action. If John Kerry can be welcomed back in the room, he can be negotiating. If the U.S. hasn't put regulations back in place, Biden is going to have to move on quickly from these great promises to getting these regulations in place, held up by the courts, working, showing a reduction in emissions, showing a change in the economy. And the world will give him a little bit of time, but not much.
So has Biden set concrete goals for lowering emissions?
He has. They're incredibly ambitious. And what's interesting about them is they are exactly in line with the targets that scientists say we need to meet to avoid the worst impacts of climate change. And at the moment, they're wildly out of line with anything that a U.S. policy could actually achieve. So he has three goals. One is to bring the U.S. to net zero carbon emissions, essentially zero carbon emissions by 2050. Imagine that, Diane. No carbon emissions in 30 years. Zero. So imagine if you know, a U.S. president had set that goal in 1990, if it could have been reached, we would be at zero carbon emissions now. That boggles the mind. But that's actually exactly what scientists say we need to do. That's the deadline that has been set by scientific report after scientific report. And then the sort of intermediate deadline that he has set for that is ending all carbon dioxide emissions from the power plant sector. That means basically no more coal or gas-fired power plants, no more fossil fuel-fired power plants in 15 years, gone. That, again, that's an appropriate first step to reach that 2050 goal. It is intensely, wildly ambitious. And then the third sort of big target that President Biden has set is spending $2 trillion just on sort of the U.S. meeting these climate goals. That one is something that I think he means to, would need to be accomplished by Congress, certainly in the next couple of years. I don't see that happening. I do not see a Congress that is struggling over how to even get together a COVID recovery package, then moving forward. I mean, this is such a sharply divided Congress. It's hard to see how they would agree to $2 trillion of spending on climate priorities, but I do think that they're going to try to find any place they can, any other kind of legislation to get climate and green money in. I think we'll see that in some of the COVID recovery.
On the other hand, Biden does have this coalition of supporters for what he wants to do, including the labor unions, the anti-fracking activists, racial justice advocates, to leaders of Wall Street and now the auto industry. So does that make it more likely he's going to be able to push through more than, say, Obama was ever able to do?
I think that depends a great deal on how much these changes in industry translate into funding and support for Republican votes. You know, I think that you still see Republican lawmakers who depend intensely on Wall Street and the fossil fuel industry, you know, for their campaign funds. And so if there were to be a really clear message that the money was also tied to a change in vote, to support for vote on climate, there might be changes in Republican votes. I don't know if we're there yet on that. And I that's something that I've been watching for many years, sort of thinking, okay, you know, some like corporations are out for their bottom line. And a lot of corporations give money to many different lawmakers, lawmakers of both parties. They hedge their bets. So at this moment, I have a hard time seeing how you get sort of a critical mass of Republican lawmakers on board with supporting a Biden climate agenda, at least this year.
On the other hand, back to GM, what does their move say about market forces, that they're all sort of finally pushing in the same direction? How might that affect both the political environment and the way the public feels about all this?
And that is a great point. Again, I feel like I've been covering this issue for so long, waiting. You know, I think on the issue of climate, there has been a shift in public opinion. Polls consistently show that voters in purple and even red states accept the science that climate change is caused by humans. Independent and Republican voters saying that they would support climate policy. You see these changes from industry. Historically, as in so many of these kind of thorny policy issues, a lot of times it's the lawmakers who are the very, very last ones to get there. And there's a lot of other political forces in play as well. It's not just constituents and corporations. I think that the influence of President Trump's, former President Trump's base of voters is still going to be very powerful. I think that if there are Republicans who feel like they still want to court that base of voters, perhaps lawmakers who are entertaining a run, I think they're going to feel that they're not going to want to be seen as giving anything to the Biden agenda. And I think that is a powerful political force. I think that there's a very good chance, just historically, we have seen that presidents who go into the White House holding both chambers of Congress historically, you know, lose the majority in one or the other in the midterms. There's no reason to think that's not going to happen this time. So if Republicans regain the Senate and or the House in 2022, I think that puts an end to any possibility of significant climate legislation.
Coral, you're being very pessimistic, I gotta say.
I think these fuel economy rules are the biggest thing that the U.S. can do on climate. I think the momentum is there in a really big way. And here's something that's optimistic on this. And I also think that, you know, that the prospects are good that they would be legally upheld. And I also think, and this is very important, Diane, so many people have said, well, okay, if Biden, you know, Obama put these climate rules in place, Trump went back and took them all away. Is Biden going to go and put these all back, and then the next Republican president is going to take them all away again? And so on these fuel economy rules, because the auto industry is there and asking for them, I think that even if these are in place, I do think that if the next Republican president come in, I do think that you will have a scenario where these companies, these corporations go in and say, look, these are in place. We've already invested in building out these model years. We do not want a whiplash, regulatory regulations back and forth. You know, they might ask for them to be like loosened up slightly, or maybe give us a little more time to meet things. I wouldn't be surprised if you saw something like that. I don't think you will see a whole industry go in and say, we got to the table to get this there, take it all away. So I think that that is one set of climate regulations, because it now will have a lot of industry buy-in, that the industry would probably even go to a Republican president and say, don't uproot this, don't tear it up. We're already there.
All right, on that positive note, we'll end our discussion. Coral, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's so great to see you, Diane.
That was Coral Davenport, reporter for the New York Times. She covers energy and environmental policy with a focus on climate change. And that's all for today. Thanks to those of you who've written in to let us know what's on your mind. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineer is Mike Kidd. Thanks for listening, all. Be well. Stay safe. I'm Diane Rehm.